Can a lack of activity kill you?
Is screening for skin cancer effective?
What's the global burden of inactivity?
And behavioral activation for depression.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on July 29th, 2016, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, we're going to focus a lot on The Lancet this week, actually. The Lancet did a couple really noteworthy things. One of them was a special issue relative to physical activity just in time for the Olympic Games. And I served up one of these studies that I thought really was quite interesting about, can a lack of physical activity kill you?
Well, Elizabeth, I know you chose this article with me in mind because there were four studies presented in that issue of The Lancet. And this one asked the question, if you sit for 8 hours or more at your desk or at work, can you do enough physical activity to overcome the increased mortality associated with sitting? They looked at six different databases that looked at both the amount of inactivity, or how much sitting someone does during the day, versus how much activity they perform during the day. What they ask is, okay, let's use a reference population. That is people that sit for less than 4 hours and do a modest amount of exercise. How do these other groups compare? And what they discovered was the more that you sit, the higher your risk of mortality. For example, if you sit for 8 hours or more per day and have little exercise, it increases your mortality by 58%. That's as much as obesity and cigarette smoking. So let's say you have one of those jobs, and you and I do, by the way. I do a lot of administrative work and you sit a lot. Can you overcome that by doing enough physical activity? And the answer is yes. If you do 65 to 90 minutes of moderate physical activity, 5 days or more per week, it reduces that mortality to as much as if you didn't have a sedentary job.
This, of course, is good news, and I at least know that I'm getting that level of physical activity, so I'm feeling okay about me. I did call into question you because I know what your day is like, and I know how infrequently you really get a chance to do that. Is there such a thing as being able to create, I'm going to call it an exercise bank? That is, you do more exercise at certain times, and that counts in offsetting the sitting behavior.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I can tell you the details of the studies. It looked at over 1 million individuals, followed them for up to 18 years, but it quantified the exercise by how much they do over a weekly period. For example, in my case, I may not exercise much during the week, but as you know, I go on the weekends and I may cycle for 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 hours. Now, is that as good as doing it on a daily basis in terms of the decrease in mortality? Unfortunately, this can't address that. But it's nice to know that as much sitting as I do, if I can get out and exercise, I can lower my risk of having a mortal event, either from cardiovascular disease or stroke or even cancer.
This is, I think, good news. I think it's also informative because, as we're well aware, we've been trying to get our arms around for quite some time exactly how much exercise does someone need to do to stay reasonably fit. And I think this study really helps to inform that.
It does. It does show there's some benefit for what our usual recommendation is, that is 30 to 50 minutes per day. But they say if you really want to lower your risk to a non-sedentary person, you have to do 60 to 95 minutes, which is a little bit more than is routinely recommended.
Well, since we're in this issue of The Lancet then, let's take a look at another study that was there looking at the global economic burden of inactivity.
I thought it was important because I don't think we have a good idea of what the global economic impact is. And this particular study is unique. And in fact, if I showed you the number of supplementary pages, it's as big as a phone book. They looked at 142 different countries that, by the way, encompasses about 94% of the world's population. They looked at the direct healthcare cost, productivity losses, and what are called the disability-adjusted life years related to inactivity. So they estimated that for each individual country and globally. If you do a very conservative estimate, physical activity costs healthcare systems over $67 billion a year. Most of that is paid by the public sector, but there's a significant amount paid by both the private sector and by individual households.
My guess is, of course, that this is an increasing problem because as people urbanize and industrialize, they become less active. So just as we're seeing increases in obesity and type 2 diabetes, my suspicion is that physical activity is also declining worldwide.
You're absolutely right. And it's estimated that it accounts for about 5 million excess deaths per year. This is a call to action, not only on an individual basis, but societally and worldwide as well.
Sounds like a whole lot of policy things and built infrastructure and all the rest. I think we'll stay with The Lancet and we will talk about, hey, do we really need to have someone who's really well trained in cognitive behavioral therapy to help someone with depression, or can we intervene with a little less education on the upside?
Well, I'm glad you chose this article because this was a type of therapy I had not heard of before. We've addressed the issue of pharmaceutical agents or pharmacology for treating depression versus cognitive behavioral therapy. We've reported that they're similar in terms of their efficacy, and people that don't want to take medications can get similar effects with cognitive behavioral therapy in terms of relieving their depression. There's a different type of therapy called behavioral activation, and as opposed to cognitive behavioral therapy, which takes trained, oftentimes licensed individuals to deliver well, behavioral activation really takes a modest amount of training. It doesn't require a healthcare professional necessarily, and it's lower cost. Let me take a step back and say, well, what is it? It's based on a theory that as individuals become depressed, they tend to engage in isolation, and the goal of treatment, therefore, is to activate them to do things. So to go out to exercise or go to dinner or learning some new skills or activity, maybe even showering regularly. And these activities, in some studies, have been shown to improve depression. And the question is, are they as effective as cognitive behavioral therapy? And so this UK study conducted in 5 different institutions looked at about 450 individuals with depression, randomized them to either cognitive behavioral therapy or to behavioral activation, and followed them for up to 18 months. And what they discovered was you can get a simpler psychologic treatment than CBT, behavioral activation, that can be delivered by junior mental health care workers with less intensive training, less costly training, and is no less effective than cognitive behavioral therapy.
We have to temper that with the idea that, in fact, we still don't have a magic bullet with regard to the treatment of depression.
No, we don't. But it's interesting. This study was conducted in the United Kingdom, but behavioral activation has also been studied in India, Iran, Iraq, low-income Latinos, and with veterans as well. So it looks like it may have applicability not only in the United Kingdom, but in other societies and cultures.
Good news. Finally, then, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. The USPSTF took a look at the evidence relative to inspecting skin for cancerous lesions and said, oops, not enough evidence to recommend this.
Yeah, Elizabeth, this study got under my skin, pun intended. And that's because as a part of my routine examination, even though I'm a cardiologist, I usually do a visual inspection of the skin with the thought that if I can identify cancer and identify it early, I can decrease mortality. Well, as you know, the USPSTF, United States Preventive Services Task Force, looks at the data critically. As you mentioned, they suggest that there's not evidence to support that. Here's what they did note. Melanoma is the skin cancer that we most fear. There'll be about 75,000 individuals in the U.S. that get it this year, about 10,000 which die. But it only constitutes about 2% of the skin cancers. 98% are either basal cell or squamous cell skin cancers, and they don't cause mortality. Detecting them early really doesn't show any benefit in terms of reducing mortality. When you look at how effective someone is at identifying melanoma, the sensitivity by visual inspection is about 40% with primary care physicians, and only about 50%, by the way, with dermatologists. So the USPSTF says there's just not good enough evidence that we can recommend it.
It does surprise me because that was with regard to melanoma, skin cancers, as well as basal cells and squamous cells.
Yes, that's the whole spectrum. So what the USPSTF says is the following. One is there are some high-risk individuals we should screen. If you have a lot of moles, for example, or a family history, or a lot of sunburns, or you spend a lot of time in the sun, those are high-risk individuals. Secondly, is we ought to be spending a lot of time talking about prevention, especially to kids. And that's probably a better use of our time than doing visual screening.
Well, this is certainly a sea change, isn't it? Because, gosh, I can recall just very recently talking about maybe people should have annual skin exams where all kinds of surfaces are examined between their toes, between their buttocks, in their scalp to try to determine if there are any of these lesions lurking about.
Yep. This study doesn't say we should do it, but what it says is we don't have good enough evidence to show that it's effective in what we're trying to do.
So, no ideas from the USPSTF on what might be effective.
Other than limiting our screening to high-risk individuals, to decrease false positives, and also preventing the practices that lead to an increased incidence of melanoma.
Okay. On that note, of course, I'm going to talk about physical activity and reduction of mortality risk in The Lancet on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live and exercise well.